Hey, y'all, I'm Kat, I'm an alcoholic. Let's have an AA meeting. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip speaker meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Now it's time for me to introduce the speaker, Lisa. I just met her before the meeting, but her other half told his story last week. And so when we were talking, she goes, yeah, it's time for the rebuttal. So anyway, I can't wait to hear it. Come on up.
I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic. And you can hear me. I can tell. Yes, my husband... I'll make sure I talk about him, but in a good way. No, in a good way. My sobriety date's March 7th, 1990, and that means I've been sober for 25 years, which is a long time, which means there's a God. And I got sober when I was 21, so, because I always do the math. I'm just going to do it for you. I don't know if I, when, as I get older if I'll keep doing that, but I'm 46. So... I got sober a month after my 21st birthday, and I like to say it was legal, so what was the fun anymore? But and I have a sponsor, and I got a new sponsor. I recently moved from Gwinnett County to Cobb County, and I need to have a sponsor that I can see regularly. And she goes to my home group, and her name is Sally, and she was the first woman that welcomed me there, and I'm grateful for that. And I like to start off by reading something to center me. And I do this different every time. Every time I tell my story, it's like, so if you don't like it this time, just wait for me to talk again because I'll say something completely different. But I always, in the mornings, I do get up. And I don't smoke anymore. I smoked for 20 years. So it took a while to get used to doing morning meditation and coffee without cigarettes. But I do it now. And I still like to sit there and read something and get centered. And sometimes I'll journal, and when I journal, I write to God. Already lost the page? Probably. But this morning, this is kind of what I opened it up to. Here it is. I'm a librarian. I can read for a long time, so if I get nervous, I'll just start reading again. Just kidding. My husband says I'm always supposed to tell this joke. It's not a joke. I wanted to be a blackjack dealer or a drug smuggler. I never wanted to be a librarian, but this is what happened. I got sober. Okay, so I'm going to read out of We Agnostics for a bit. And before I start, though, the reason when I started reading this, Bill uses a lot of language in the literature that I don't know the definition of, because every time I look up the words, I'm like, wow, I didn't know it meant that. And one of the words he uses a lot, and my husband used this in his story last week, foundation and foundation stone or cornerstone. So this morning when I opened up in the big book, I'm like, well, what is the difference in a foundation stone or a cornerstone? And according to Wikipedia, there is no difference. The definition said a cornerstone or foundation stone is the first stone set, and it determines the position of the entire structure. All right, so there's a definition. So here's what I'm going to read, and it's going to have that word in it. I'm a recovering middle school teacher, too, so watch for the word. Okay. We needed to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. That was great news for us, for we had assumed we could not make use of spiritual principles unless we accepted many things on faith, which seemed difficult to believe. When people presented us with spiritual approaches, how frequently did we all say, I wish I had what that man has. I'm sure it would work if I could only believe as he believes. But I cannot accept as surely true the many articles of faith which are so plain to him. So it's comforting to learn we could commence at a simpler level. Besides the seeming inability to accept much on faith, we found ourselves handicapped by obstinacy, sensitiveness, and unreasoning prejudice. Many of us have been so touching that even casual reference to spiritual things made us bristle with antagonism. This sort of thinking had to be abandoned. Though some of us resisted, we found no great difficulty in casting aside such feelings. Faced with alcoholic destruction, we soon became as open-minded on spiritual matters as we had tried to be on other questions. In this respect, alcohol was a great persuader. It finally beat us into a state of reasonableness. I'm going to stop there. Good stuff, though. When I came into the rooms, I did not come in having any belief in any higher power whatsoever. As a matter of fact, my first meeting, I remember after the first meeting was over, I was walking around and I was talking to the guy I was dating at the time. We'd been in a relationship for 2 years. He had lost his driver's license, so I took him to a meeting. And while I was there, I picked up a white chip. But I remember talking to him after the meeting. We were walking around and I said, you know, I said, this whole God thing, I don't get it. And I can't imagine how I could ever come to believe in a power greater than me, because I had a lot of ego and pride, and that bristled with antagonism. I say this, if you had any type of Christian bumper sticker on your car, I just wanted to rear-end you. I saw that as complete weakness, and that anybody that had any belief in a higher power was surely fooling themselves. And I did not need that. I was a big Pat Benatar fan, and that song that she did, "Hit Me with Your Best Shot," and I was thinking about this the other day. I'm a different person today for many reasons, but one of the things that's very different about me today is that I can ask for help. I can ask my higher power for help, and I can ask you guys in the rooms for help. And gosh, I do a lot. And but when I got here, I was very afraid, and I was in a tremendous amount of pain, and I didn't want to quit drinking. There's a lot of outside issues. I didn't want to stop either, but I didn't want to, because I didn't know how to live and deal with feelings without taking something. That first meeting, I also remember thinking, how could I ever stop crying if I couldn't take something to make me stop crying? Because I cried a lot. And I hit an emotional bottom. And I'm grateful that I kept coming back. I'd like to tell you I only picked up one white chip, but that's not the case. I had to test it. I remember telling my stepdad that I wasn't going to drink when I needed to drink anymore. I was just going to drink when I wanted to drink. And I'm thinking that was some great revelation that I could twist it. I remember I got a job. I worked in restaurants and bars a lot. And my first job I got when I was 16 was at a restaurant. And I got that job when I was 16 because I knew if I made tips, I could lie to my parents about how much money I made. And I could spend all that money partying just the way I wanted to. And I did that a lot. And so the God thing was when I was in my first treatment center, which I went to, by the way, because I didn't want to go to work that day. And I begged my stepdad, can I please go to treatment today? Because I thought that would be a much better thing. I had gotten a job out of the bar. I was working in JCPenney's. And selling clothes was not a lot of fun when you are as hungover as I was. And so I went to that first treatment center, and I had picked up a lot of white chips at that point. And I wanted this thing, but I couldn't get it. One of the things in that I read, and I read a long time, I didn't think I could get this thing. Because I could see a lot of you getting it, and I could see a lot of you guys staying sober. And I believe that it worked for you, but I was different, and I didn't think it worked for me. I went through 3 treatment centers in a year, and none of them were court mandated. None of them were to get out of any trouble. The first time, of course, was that I didn't want to go to work. But I really wanted this sobriety thing, and I was having the darndest time. And what would happen usually when I got about 30 days, it seemed like all the numbness would wear off. You know, it wasn't like on day 2 or 3 that my skin wasn't that crawling, and I didn't want to drink or whatever. But after 30 days, it seemed like there was nothing left to numb me. And I would relapse a lot between 30 and 60 days. So I'm getting ahead of myself. So in that first treatment center, I was told to go read We Agnostics. And because I didn't believe in this whole higher power thing. So I went upstairs and I read that. And I came downstairs and I told this woman who was a recovering alcoholic. And I told her, I said, okay, now what? And she said, you need to go read that again. So I went and read that again. And I didn't have a burning bush experience. But what I realized on that second reading, I guess I became open, and you know, our literature is pretty darn good. I realized the only reason I was still alive was because there had to be a power out there greater than me. Because there were so many times I had put myself in so many situations, and I should have been dead so many times. I'm not talking too much about the problem. I want to qualify myself. I drank alcoholically, and in that first treatment center, I heard a guy talk about how he drank alcoholically, and he said he drank higher proof alcohol, and I could totally relate to that. I am not a big person, and I don't have the biggest bladder, so I learned that if I drank liquor straight, I did not have to go to the ladies' room as often. Oh, excuse me, I didn't usually go to the ladies' room. I was usually in the woods because I was never drinking at a legal age, so I did try to keep portable tissues with me in my purse. I remembered this recently. I told you that first job I got in, I was working in a restaurant and I was 16, and we didn't even serve alcohol there. And I was a hostess, and they would let me wait tables, which means at 16 I was actually making a lot of money. But there was a regular customer. Now, this was a barbecue restaurant in Greensboro, North Carolina. I don't even remember the name of it. And this gentleman, I was 20 at the time, or no, I was 16 at the time. This gentleman came in one day, and he was a regular customer there. And one day he snuck me a bottle of, it was in a mason jar of moonshine. Now, why would you give a 16-year-old girl a bottle of moonshine? And I figured that he probably could just tell that I would probably drink that moonshine. It's the shortest game of quarters I've ever played. Quarters don't last too long on moonshine. I moved out of the house when I was 16, so I could drink the way I wanted to. That's when I was drinking that moonshine that one night. And I drank every night when I had the opportunity to drink every night. And I remember getting sick, and I had like a bad cold or whatever, and I just kept thinking, if I just drink screwdrivers because of the orange juice, I'll get well. And that didn't work either. But I drank alcoholically. I know that I could tell you a lot of stories, and then I couldn't talk about recovery. I did that recently. I'm going to make sure I don't do that tonight. But I drank alcoholically. One thing, I don't know if anybody remembers Everclear. You know, there's a lot of punch in that. You know, it's a high proof. So because I was usually drinking underage, I would sometimes carry a pint of Everclear in my purse so that, and I would go in the bathroom stalls and drink that. And that's probably not what normal drinkers do. When my boyfriend at the time, he drank Wild Turkey 101, and I could not stand the way that stuff smelled on him when he drank. So I learned that if I drank it, I didn't smell it. And so that was my solution. So I drank alcoholically, and I never got a DUI. It's funny, I taught DUI school not long ago for a while as a second job. I had a lot of fun teaching DUI school. And I don't know how many of y'all have been, but I'm getting more than one person in this room has been through DUI class. But, you know, they show the movies and everything, and I've been sober 25 years, and I had been sober at least 18 years by the time I taught DUI school. And it took 18 years of sobriety to sit in that class and watch those movies and realize that the wreck I had when I was 17, because I had a wreck when I was 17 and I was drinking and driving, and I hit another car, and I was going about 45 miles an hour, and the party was to my left, and I took that turn. And when I took that turn, I hit a car, and it was, I think, a New Yorker, and I hit it so hard it did a complete 360 and knocked me down the road, and I couldn't get out of the car because I was stuck. And as soon as my car came to a screeching halt, I'd had a cough, and I had some throat lozenges, mentholiptus ones, and I started eating them like candy because I knew I was drunk. And I didn't want the police to know I'd been drinking. And but the point in that is I walked away from that, and the car that I hit, those three women went away in an ambulance. And I was 17 at the time, and I thought, you know, they went away with neck braces, and I said, they just want to sue me. And that was my complete belief. I had really no regret or remorse for what I had done. I just thought, they're looking to sue me. They did attempt to sue me. I had no money because I was a 17-year-old alcoholic. But it took until I was actually teaching DUI school that I realized, watching the movies that we show in there, that I could have actually changed those women's lives forever. They were definitely daughters. They could have been mothers. They certainly were old enough to be mothers. And so sometimes the awareness of my actions don't show up right away. This is probably going to be more revealing. So I told my story about a week ago, and I didn't like what I said. I just didn't. And so sometimes in the morning I said I get up and I read literature, and I ask God every morning to keep me clean and sober, because I can't. The women that I sponsor in AA, I suggest they do that. If I could get me sober or keep me sober, I wouldn't need these rooms. I tried that. So I hit my knees every morning. It's been a long time that I have forgotten to do that before I leave. Years ago, when I was still developing this habit, there were times I would leave the house and realize, oh, crap, I forgot to do that. And I'm sure I heard this from a speaker, but I could totally relate that when they hit their knees in the morning, it's kind of like plugging in. I actually imagine, like, I can see a visual, like my knees are like the prongs in the plug. And until I've connected there, I just can't start my day. That doesn't mean I'm perfect, but it means that I do that. And I relapse a lot. I said, and the last time I came back in, I am very grateful that someone said, you know, just don't drink for today, no matter what. And I added that, and that no matter what is something that I still ask God to keep me clean and sober. But so, wow, I didn't get back to the cornerstone, did I? Well, I guess that is it. I guess I am at the cornerstone. You know, I had to believe that there was a God and that it wasn't me. And when I became willing, and it took me a while to become willing, but when I really became willing to pray, to the best of my knowledge, when I sincerely, well, actually, no, I wasn't sincere. When I finally became willing to take some of the suggestions, and I was willing to hit my knees and pray to a God that I really wasn't sure was there, but I was going to give you guys the benefit of the doubt, okay, I'm still alive, there's something there, I didn't have to drink after that. Now, I'd love to tell you that the desire to drink was completely lifted at that point. That's not my story. The compulsion never came back. I never got past the compulsion to drink. When you know that feeling when it comes on you, where like it doesn't matter what happens, I don't care what happens, I don't care if I don't care. Where I'm going to drink, and if you're in my way, I'm going to plow you down. I never got past that compulsion. The desire to drink left me at about 9 months sober. And for that, I'm grateful. I didn't take all the suggestions, though. I did pray. And I did get a sponsor. And I told you in the beginning, I thought I was different. And I had a very wise sponsor that recognized that in me, because I told her I was afraid. I had been through my third treatment center in a year, and I was in a halfway house, and I told her that I was afraid that it wasn't going to work again. And she said I needed to change my thinking, because I think alcoholics have, I mean, this alcoholic, I definitely have a problem with my thinking, and I know it talks a lot about that in our literature, and especially in the doctor's opinion. And I thought I was different, and she helped me to see that unless I believed that it was possible for me to stay sober, that I wasn't going to be able to stay sober. And that was big. That was big. I forget that sometimes. And she gave me a book, and it wasn't AA approved. You know, she gave me a book called The Power of Positive Thinking by Norman Vincent Peale. And I had to read that book to believe it was possible for me, because I have relapsed a lot, and I was afraid that it wouldn't work. And that book helped me see that it's possible even for me to do this. And I had a tremendous fear of not working the steps. And that's the best fear I can ever say. You know, afraid you're going to drink, like, you know. I ask God to remove my fears a lot, but there's some healthy fears, and I was afraid I was going to drink. So I didn't take all the suggestions, but I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps. And I remember that first four-step. Her name was Donna. Donna loved me to death. And Donna was a nurse at a treatment center. And I had moved to Galax, Virginia, and I told you I didn't take all the suggestions. I had gotten in relationships, and I had gotten pregnant. And I was working at Sonny's Barbecue part-time in Roswell here. And they wouldn't give me any more hours, and I was about 6 months pregnant. And I was living with a guy that was not the father of that child that was budding in my growing belly. And one day I came home, and he was gone. And that sucked. And because my butt fell off, and I was going to meetings, and I had a sponsor, but I was real dependent on that relationship, and I didn't have any money, and I didn't have rent money, and you know, this is where I learned to ask for help in the beginning. I guess I called one of you guys, and there was a girl named Anna, and Anna let me come sleep on her couch. Now, honestly, I was 6 months pregnant. I was working part-time at Sonny's. I had about 9 months sober. I wasn't sleeping. I was in withdrawal from that relationship. I'm going to tell you right now. I remember I was pregnant. My entire belly ached because I was so tense and so afraid, and I didn't know what to do. So I took my butt to a meeting, and I surrounded myself with you guys, and y'all loved me. But I did end up moving because my stepdad was in Galax, Virginia, and he took me in, and that was where I found that sponsor, Donna. And you know, you got to get things in ready before you have a baby, and one of the things I had to get ready was to do a four-step before the child came. And I knew I didn't get sober because I was pregnant. I didn't find out I was pregnant until I was 3 months pregnant, by the grace of God. I had two pregnancy tests from a clinic come back negative. Sometimes I wonder if my son really knows how much God wanted him to be born. He's 24 now, and he's never had to see me take a drink. And for that, I am so grateful. I didn't stay sober for him, but I knew that if I drank, I couldn't take care of him. And I knew that I had to take care of me. One of the things, I haven't talked about this in a long time, that actually made me seek recovery. My mother is not an alcoholic. She married them, and she's married to her third one, and I love her, and I wish she had a program. I'm just grateful that she's, you know, I'm sincerely grateful that she's married to an alcoholic that doesn't abuse her. She's actually got the dream alcoholic. He's afraid of traveling and driving, so he stays at home and drinks. The Al-Anon dream for my mother, but she was, I was an only child, and she was pregnant right before I came in the room with her second child. So I have a half-brother who is, I'm 46, and Travers is 26, I think. And I had a lot of resentments, and I had so much anger when I first got sober about what my mom did and didn't do that I thought she should do raising me. And I know she did the best she could do, but I had a lot of resentments. And I remember I wanted to get sober, because I was so full of myself and so prideful and so arrogant and so angry, because I thought I should get sober so I could take care of that child and take custody away from her, because I was so angry at her. I was so angry at her as a teenager. I remember thinking if she died, I needed to practice crying because I resented her so much. So we have a good relationship today. She calls me every week. She lives in Arizona, which is far away. I have a good relationship with my grandmother today, who raised me a lot. But I did not like my mother as a teenager. I sat in these rooms early on. My grandmother was so ashamed of me because I was pregnant. Because in my household, you were supposed to look good. Grandma sent me clothes during my drinking days so that I looked good. Because I wasn't going to buy any. I spent all of my the money that I made, and I kept two jobs when I was drinking. Usually, yeah, I kept two jobs so that I could party the way I wanted to party. And my grandmother always sent me clothes. I'm going to jump way ahead. I'm doing good on time this time. My grandmother lives in Tucson, Arizona as well. My mother and grandmother both live out there. We're not from there. They moved out there. I don't imagine why anyone would want to live in a desert. I don't want to move out there. I'd rather them move back this coast. But my grandmother, when I decided to get sober this last time, I moved in with her because I wanted a safe place to live. And it was an attempted geographical cure, and she lived in Roswell. And I moved in with her in Roswell. And I relapsed with her a few times, and she helped me with her treatment. And then I finally got it. And, you know, the miracle happened. I came to believe there was a power greater than me, and I did the deal, and I did the step work. But anyway, my grandmother is widowed, and she went on a trip a couple years ago. And grandma's 80. I don't know, she's in her 80s. But she likes to travel, and we encourage her to travel. But she went on this trip she was going to be a cruise, and she went with a friend of hers, another woman, and they stopped in Istanbul, and my grandmother fell. And she ended up in intensive care in Istanbul. And this is just a good story because it tells you how awesome this program is. So she's in Istanbul in intensive care, and that woman she went with went on the cruise and left her there in intensive care. My grandmother doesn't speak Turkish, and we tried to get her flown back out, and she wasn't stable enough to fly out. And my mother and my uncle, neither one of them could go. They didn't want to go. My uncle, it made sense that he would go, but he didn't want to go. So this was my grandmother. And this was the grandmother that I had lived with during my youth when my mother lost custody of me. And this was the grandmother that had let me live in with her alone to get sober and paid for my second treatment center. And the one that helped me when I got sober and I decided to go back to college. She helped me pay for school, and she helped me pay for my car. And I'd forgiven her, obviously. And I flew to Turkey and Istanbul. Before I went, though, this is just so cool. So I thought, okay, I'd like to know somebody before I go there. That's a long shot, right? So I Google on my phone at work one day, AA meetings in Istanbul, and bam, I hit something. And there was a guy's phone number named Russell. And I texted Russell in Istanbul from Gwinnett County. And I said, my grandmother is in ICU out there, and I'm in AA, and I want to come out there. I said, and I want to go to a meeting. He said, come on. And he texted me back. And it took me a few days to get those plane tickets. And it bothered me that she was out there. And I would call her while she was in ICU. And she was kind of doing worse. She was there. And it wasn't that, of course, she was actually in a very nice hospital. It's a small private hospital. And they were taking good care of her. But you know what? She's a woman who's like in her 80s. And she's alone in this foreign country. And I talked to Russell, and I said, you know, she's alone, and she can't talk to anybody in her language. He was British. He was from England. He was, like, teaching English classes over there in Istanbul. And this man did an amazing work of service because he actually went before I got there. He had never met me. And he went to the hospital, which was very far away from where he lived, and took my grandmother Turkish Delight candy and sat there and visited with her and talked with her in English for hours the day before I got there, because he was another member of AA, and he saw that there was a need to be there. So it's a great story. So I have time for this. So I had plane tickets. I got, you know, it was just God shows up. I love the saying that God likes to stay anonymous through coincidences, and there were so many coincidences. He didn't remain anonymous to me on this trip because the plane tickets, it was amazing. I flew to Istanbul cheaper than I can fly to Tucson. And I've never flown internationally, and I'm not one of those people that know how to do that. And when I got off the plane in Turkey, I didn't have a plan. I didn't really have time to have much of a plan. My only plan was, someone said, just go to the ticket place where you can exchange money. Because I didn't have time to do that before I went either. So I'm sitting there in Istanbul, and I'm waiting for my luggage to get off the luggage thing, and it's not showing up, and I'm very tired because it's a long couple of plane rides. And standing there, this man stands next to me, and he says, "Donna, I recognize you from the plane out of Atlanta." And I said, "Yes." And he had an accent, but he spoke perfect English. And he said, "Why are you here in Turkey?" And I told him I was there to see my grandmother in the hospital. And he said, "Huh." He said, "I live in Sandy Springs, I think that's where, Dunwoody." And he said, "But I'm from Turkey." And he said, and it's apparent that since we're here and the luggage isn't there, our luggage has been lost. And he said, "So here's what I'm going to do." He said, "I'm going to take you over there to that missing lost luggage, and I'm going to help you fill out that paperwork." And he said, "Now I have a driver that's here to meet me, and I'm going to have that driver take you to the hospital to see your grandmother." So that's what he did. And it was way far away, and wow, do they drive crazy in Turkey. And it was like rush hour. That driver, I know, went out of his way at least an hour to take me there. And when we got to the hospital, he walked me in, and he made sure that I could communicate with the people at the desk so that I could actually find my grandmother's room. And he called me the next day at my grandmother's room to make sure that I got my luggage. That's all good, but I think it gets even better. While I was there for a week with my grandmother, and AA took care of me. I'm not an international traveler. I did not know to bring an adapter for my phone to charge it, because there's different plugs over there, so just heads up. So to let the people back home know that I was there and alive, I needed to have some kind of contact. So Russell, that guy, took me to an AA meeting there. And you know what? It was in a church, and they all spoke English. And the meetings were more like the meetings I went to in Gwinnett than the ones I go to in Cobb County now. I felt completely at home. So y'all took great care of me there, and you took care of me before I got there. But my grandmother was not real touchy-feely when I was growing up. And I realized while I was there with her on that last day before both of us were going back home that there were some things I really wanted to tell her, because I realized before I left for this trip how much she really meant to me. You know, when you realize you might lose someone, that reality sets in on how much they might mean to you. And I wanted to be able to tell my grandmother how much she meant to me and how grateful I was. But I was having a real hard time being that vulnerable with her. And I even remember I found a way to text for free back home. And I was even texting my sponsor saying, "You know, I don't have the courage to do this. I think I'm going to write her a letter." And as I'm sending that text message, my grandmother, we're laying in bed. It's nighttime. It's the last night before we're there. And she starts talking. And she tells me how everybody had told her to give up on me. And how she didn't, and how she loved me, and she didn't give up no matter what everybody told her. And I had never known this. You know, I knew that she was my grandmother, and I just had those expectations that grandma's going to be there and that she'll love me and take care of me. And but the reality was that I was in her home causing a lot of havoc, and I'm sure I was causing her a lot of pain. I certainly was causing her a lot of money with treatment centers. And so I had to go all the way to Istanbul to realize that I had amends that I had not made to my grandmother, you know. And I got to tell her, because she was braver than I was, how much she meant to me and how grateful I was for her. That was the best part of the trip. I will say, coming back, we went back on separate flights. She was a lot better, and she went back to Arizona, and I went back to Atlanta. And I stayed in the hospital room with her, so I didn't have a place to stay when her plane left and mine didn't. And my plane didn't leave for probably about, 16, 18 hours. So that was a lot of time to kind of hang out in Istanbul. AA again took care of me. Y'all took me to another meeting. Y'all took me out to eat. Y'all took me to coffee shops. Y'all took me to the airport. And you loved me and made sure that I got back on that plane home. And I just love that story because it incorporates the steps and how we do this deal. What should I talk about now? I have a few more minutes. I talked about asking for help. The story isn't as good, but it's still a good one. I couldn't finish. I tried to do some college courses before I got sober. That did not work well for me. I could not. If I left school, I'd get loaded. And so the few classes, I got one A before I got sober. I got an A in aerobics. Yeah, nice, right? And but there was English 101 that that's a normal college course you have to take. Now, I had been a bright student before I quit high school my junior year. And English, even when I quit high school my junior year, I was in an advanced English class. Maybe that's where I'm going with this. And I remember Mrs. Shockley, that advanced English class teacher, so I'm going to flash way back in time to when I was 16 before I quit high school. Because the shame that I felt at that point in my life was so tremendous. And we were reading the book, The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. I never finished that book. I think of it as being a great alcoholic thing, though. I'm not going to tell you the story, but there's a woman, the main character was an adulteress. She got pregnant out of wedlock, and she was forced to wear this A on her clothes as a mark of shame. And I related so much to that character because I had a lot of shame for what I was doing at that point, even at 16. I had a tremendous amount of shame, and I honestly think that one of the reasons that I could not stand that teacher is because she was making me read that story, which was bringing up all those feelings. And when I came into the room, I'd like to tell you that shame just went away. It didn't. It's a part of me that I carry with me. I was listening to a speaker, though, today on the way here, and she talked about the disease concept. And I'm like, oh, yeah, Lisa, you're an alcoholic, and you have the disease of alcoholism. And it's a disease. It's not because I'm a bad person, and it's not because I'm stupid, and it's not because of anything other than it's a disease. And the actions that I took during my active alcoholism were shameful. There's nothing pretty about a woman who's drunk. Nothing very attractive about a guy that's drunk either. But certainly there's nothing pretty about a woman that's drunk. And I didn't come in the rooms screaming of sobriety. I came in the rooms wanting some relief from that pit in my stomach. And I remember how big that gaping hole was in my stomach. I was in so much pain. And I wanted it to go away. And I truly believe that hole was that God-shaped hole. And I believe that every time I drank, that I probably just made that hole bigger. And it became like an ulcer. And I needed God so bad. Sandy Beach says that he does. He thinks alcoholics just need God more, and I needed God so bad. And I had been praying by accident, and it took me a while to realize I had been praying by accident. Because remember, I told you I didn't believe there was a God at all. And I remembered, though, after I had been sober for a while, that there were plenty of times when I was so hungover and so sick that I would be sitting there on my knees because I was sick. And I would be saying, God, help me. Because I think that's just natural. It just comes from within. It talks about in the book how deep inside all of us there is that belief, that fundamental belief that there was a God. And I had that huge God-sized hole and so much shame. And it took a while to learn to fill that up. I I was looking at step 11 a few years ago, and it talks in step 11. Okay, I really know the step. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. But somehow, maybe I'm interpreting it wrong, but somehow I thought, you know, if you want to have a relationship with someone, you have to be willing to spend time with them. You know? So I am not a meditation guru. There are different things I have done. When I first came in the rooms, I'm a seeker. When I first came in the rooms, I went to some channeling thing. I don't know, one of y'all took me and said, oh, there's this really cool church, and there was somebody that sat up there and they channeled someone else. And that was kind of creepy. I think I got something out of it. I remember that channeler with their eyes rolled back in their head kind of looking at me and saying something that was similar in spiritual to what you guys said in the room. So, you know, I was a seeker. When I was pregnant with my son, I went to a lot of Native American stuff back in the day, at least in my circles. And there was a sweat lodge. And that was a really cool experience because I got to sit in this really hot place where we all sweated a lot. And I was very pregnant. And all those people in there said lots of prayers for my son before he was born. So I was seeking, and that was different from all the times that I relapsed. And I continue to want to grow that relationship with my higher power. So, and I believe you do that with the steps. Last night, there's a woman that asked me to sponsor her the other day, and she and I have a lot in common. And one of the things I learned from a former sponsor is before you say yes, make sure that you know what they want out of a sponsor and make sure you communicate what you can give to them. So she asked me, and I said, okay, do me a favor, write down what you want. And she did, and she texted it to me. It's a very long text. But that's okay because it was in writing. And as before, I was going to bed last night, a little antsy about this and everything, and the gift of service work, right? The gift of service work. So I was able to get out of my head and reply with this very long text. And I said, my primary job as a sponsor is to guide you through the steps and to help you apply them to your daily life. In the process, you will have a spiritual awakening and become closer to God. Promise. And I realize I can promise that because the steps promise that, and that's been my experience. And I'm grateful that I get to sponsor women because I get to go through the steps again. I was not the person in the rooms that you always wanted what I had. As a matter of fact, it took many years for you guys or you ladies to want me to sponsor you because a lot of the time you didn't want what I had. I was telling my husband on the way here, I did not do as much service work as I could have done. I did the best I can do. I know I did some service work because I remember sitting in a group conscience one time. I don't know if I should say this. This is being taped, right? And I was new in sobriety, and my son was little, and I remember recommending that out with the literature they also include condoms because AIDS was a really big deal at the time, and I thought we were all going to kill ourselves. And I thought that that was a legitimate motion. And you know what? You guys loved me and you let me stay and you just said, well, okay, maybe we'll vote on that later. That motion did not pass. I know I did a little bit of service work, but I didn't do a lot and obviously I didn't have a clue. I went through the steps again. I got lazy. I got complacent and I rested on my laurels and I didn't want to drink, but I became miserable when I had about 17 years sober. I went back and got a master's degree and I had a teenager and I worked full time and something had to give and I let AA be that had to give. And I have a tremendous amount of compassion and love for newcomers, but I also have a tremendous amount of compassion and love for the people that have been around because it is really freaking hard to come back in these rooms and be hurting like I was hurting, but everybody knew I'd been sober for a long time, and they're like, where you been? And it's really hard to look at other people and say, you need to go to meetings when my meeting attendance had been pitiful. And my sponsor had moved away, and my husband at the time was relapsing, and my son was getting kicked out of school for marijuana. And I was miserable. And I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps. And I'm also a member of our sister fellowship, Al-Anon, because I need both, and I had two sponsors, and they both agreed that I needed to inventory my relationships because there was a trail of wreckage I had left. And I, in the big book, I can't quote it, I'm not going to look it up right now in the essence of time, but in the big book, at the end of the fourth step and how it works, the part about sex, which is on page 69, if you can't find it. But I don't know, did it change when we changed? Okay, it used to be on page 69. I don't know what version it is now. But at the end it says, this helped us shape a sound ideal for our future sex life. And so what my sponsor told me I needed to do was I needed to write down all the relationships I'd been in, even the ones like the boys from seventh grade that I just had a crush on. I wrote them all down. And I looked at my part in them. And I had to make a lot of phone calls. Now, I didn't find everybody from 7th grade, but there was a lot of people that I owed amends to, and a lot of them were in recovery because I got sober at 21, and I dated a lot of y'all in recovery and married a couple, too. And so it was very humbling to sit across those coffee tables and make those amends to those people. And it was probably one of the most powerful things I've done. Because I got to see how selfish and self-centered I was. And then I got to write that sound ideal of, she said, now I want you to write what you want in a relationship. And at that point, I was pretty much done. I said, you know what? I said, I understand that whole arranged marriage thing. And if I'm supposed to get married again, I'm sure that my sponsor could pick someone better for me because my picker is broken. But that sound ideal was, I listed the things that were most important for me if I would ever have a relationship again. And the first one was that they have a spiritual relationship, a connection with a higher power. I wish I had the list with me. There was a lot of things on that list. It was an unrealistic list, I thought. But I made it because my sponsor suggested that I make it. And then I met Sean, who was your speaker last week. And I didn't mean to meet him. And you know what? This is a God thing because he knew the same people I knew for a long time. And, like, we didn't know each other. And, you know, we've both been in the rooms for a while. So God knew that I had a lot of getting ready to do. And maybe he did, too. But I certainly did before I was ready for him. I know beyond a shadow of a doubt I would not have been attracted to him, nor would he have been attracted to me if I had not done a lot of the work that I did. And I don't think I was done until I was done. And the cool thing was after Sean and I started dating for a while, that I'm like, oh, yeah, I made that list. Let me pull it out and look. And it was so cool because having done the work and listened to my sponsor and make that unrealistic list, and Sean exceeded everything on that list. Now, okay, he's not perfect. But early on, I prayed that I would learn to love him the way he loves me. Because he accepts me with all my warts just the way I am. And that is a wonderful gift that the program and y'all have given me. And I'm out of time. And I'm going to stop talking. Thanks for listening.
Knock down. Amen.